Hey, I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Jay Speaker, journalistically speaking, and I'm coming to you right now because there's an urgent meeting that is taking place right now in Qatar. So Arab leaders, along with Gulf states, are having a special meeting that they have called to deal with this Doha strike on the part of Israel. To say that they're angry is the least of it. Obviously, the Emir of Qatar has spoken in very angry terms about what Israel did. He keeps saying things like, "I can't believe, have you ever heard of anything like this?" And if anything, as a matter of fact, I'm about to show you an interview that I just did with a Qatari who is a very important member of the Global Alliance, who is actually saying that he tends to think, now think about this, that Israel is isolating itself from the world. And to a certain extent, and I've said this before, and I've said it in a bunch of interviews I've done over the weekend with Indian officials or Indian television networks, as well as Chinese television networks, that there's a certain self-isolation that's taking place in the West, including our own country, the United States, in many ways. And the point is that even he says that there is a lean, and will be a lean by countries like Qatar, et cetera, toward the Global South community, toward Russia, toward China, toward India, and away from the West. And that it's just obvious. The writing is on the wall, is I think the word that he used. I also ask him a lot about whether he holds the United States accountable, who he holds in Israel accountable. He's putting it all on Bibi, saying he doesn't think the Israeli people would be willing to do something like this. He called it a criminal act of terror in our conversation. He confirmed that there was a Qatari killed, a 22-year-old kid who was part of the military assignment there. So here is my conversation with a Qatari official who expresses, and he's so glib and so human and so conciliatory, in many ways, more than I would be after something like this happened in my country. Could you imagine somebody shoots a bomb into your country and kills one of your fellow countrymen simply because you're trying to create peace with their neighbors or with their opposition? It's really nutty, but that's what it is. Here's my conversation with Rashid Al-Mohammadi. Rashid Al-Mohammadi is a resident fellow, Middle East Council for Global Affairs. It is an absolute pleasure to have you here. Thank you, sir, for joining us. What do you think of the comments by the Emir?
Well, I think not only the Emir is angry, the entire region is fuming with what happened. An equivalent would be if the U.S. decided to assassinate the Taliban negotiation team during the U.S.-Taliban mediation that occurred in Doha. That succeeded in ending the U.S. longest war in its history. That would be the only equivalent, which is just ludicrous.
There's another case I could give you, only because it comes to mind as I'm hearing you say that. About a month ago, there was an Israeli official who went to Las Vegas. Have you heard about this? While he was in Las Vegas, he was caught by the FBI trying to have sex with a 15-year-old girl. He's an Israeli official. He was there for a conference. A computer conference. He was apprehended. An Israeli official who works in the Nevada state government got him out. They put him on a plane and flew him back to Israel. It would be, I would say, as if the United States would bomb tomorrow Tel Aviv and say, you have somebody there who's a criminal, who committed a criminal act in our country. We want him back, and we're going to kill him while he's on your soil. Why not? Isn't that the precedent that's been set? In that case, I would actually agree with it more.
That would be a good analogy. You don't go bombing other states because they're hosting a side you opposed to in a mediation you asked for. It is just ridiculous what happened last week. It's not ridiculous. It's criminal.
Did you ever...
it's terror.
Did you ever, pardon me, I thought you were finished, I apologize. Did you even, did anyone in Qatar think, comprehend, imagine that something like this could happen? After all, there is precedent for it. They had done something similar in Lebanon and had done something similar in Syria, and the other one doesn't come to mind, but I can think of at least three or four cases where they have done this before.
Those cases, even though I don't agree with them, were against combatants during a war. There is some military value to these strikes. What happened in Doha was attacking the mediation platform and attacking the negotiation party, while I might remind everybody that there are still Israeli hostages within Gaza that have not been freed. And this potential deal that was being negotiated would have helped in that. And, you know, my discussions with policymakers here in Qatar are saying that this was potentially a break, a deal that would provide a breakthrough in the hostage situation.
I understand. I was looking this up today. There were four or five people killed, and one of them was a Qatari. It was a colonel in your military who was killed by these Israeli missiles. I didn't know that before. I mean, that's kind of a big deal. They killed one of your citizens.
Well, yes, we had one martyr, Bader al-Dosri. He was part of the internal security forces, which we call Lahwiya. Uh-huh. They are in charge of protecting diplomatic missions. Bader, you know, may God bless his soul, was actually one of the police officers protecting the U.S. embassy at some time. So it's an unfortunate loss what happened. And, I send my condolences through you know, your platform to his family. And the condolences to the entire Qatari people.
Thank you, sir. Understandable. It was just a guy who was trying to do his job, and he was thinking he was protected by the auspices, right? Say again?
He was 22.
Wow.
He did not even live his life.
And he assumed...
And I don't want to share too much detail, but the only way he was been able to be identified was through what was left of his body.
Wow. That says something about the impact itself. I'm just wondering what can come out of this summit, for example. What do you think the response should be for Israel? As I mentioned, you may have heard me a little while ago, I had a conversation with one of Mr. Netanyahu's dear friends and officials, former IDF intel guy, just a couple of days ago, and he did not have very good things to say about the Qataris. He had horrible things to say about Qatar and thought that essentially, when I questioned him and told him that it was wrong to do what he did, he said that you guys deserved it. What's the response to someone who says something like that? And what should be the response to Israel?
Well, unfortunately, Netanyahu himself and many of his friends have become morally broke and politically broke. They are trying, and this is, my assessment. It's short-termism for the gain of political survival. And we see this through the statements and the narrative that's trying to be pushed, equating what happened to the assassination of Osama bin Laden. You are either uninformed or you're stupid if you'd believe in this comparison. And it's silly. Honestly, it's silly, but it shows that the Israeli establishment, at least this is what I believe, were not involved in such a decision. And when you understand the Israeli military establishment, this decision could only come from one person, which is the prime minister.
You think that maybe it was Smoltrick, for example, and others who are part of his war cabinet who are just... described by even some people in Israel who I know and my other friends in the United States who are very pro-Israel, they say to me these people are crazy. Do you think it was that little cabal that actually was able to pull this off without it being the will of the Israeli people?
Of course not. Of course not. It's against Israeli national interest what happened. Qatar was a conduit for Israel, even though we don't have official diplomatic ties, for them to negotiate with Hamas and get their hostages out and potentially negotiate a ceasefire. May I remind you that also Qatar was instrumental in negotiating a ceasefire between Israel and Iran during their 12-day war. So it's against Israeli national interests, number two. There are some reports that even the Mossad were either against or not informed with this attack. And it honestly, it makes sense because the Mossad has a vested interest in normalizing with Gulf states. And bombing a Gulf state does not help, you know, this Israeli national interest to be achieved. So I think it's just political short-termism.
In fact, I mean, if we really want to get down to brass tacks here, you know, many of the Gulf states, including Qatar, were part of the Abraham Accords. They literally have bent over backward to try and create conditions where Israel can be part of the fabric of the Middle East, and have actually even tried to mend fences between Israel and other Arab countries. I mean, you've done a lot to try and help Israel. Do you feel like they have stabbed you in the back?
So to answer your last question first, of course, we feel stabbed in the back. But Qatar was not part of the Abraham Accords. From the Gulf, it was just the UAE and Bahrain. But let me, you know, shed some light on Qatar-Israeli relations. Qatar was the first Gulf state to somewhat normalize relations with Israel in 1998 when we opened a representation office here in Doha, very close to my think tank's office. It was only closed after the Israelis refused to stop bombing Beirut in 2006. So Qatar actually, you know, pushed a lot, and we got bashed in the media and, you know, through any other Arab states for what we've done.
Thank you for the correction, by the way. I thought that they were part of it. I'm sure in spirit they were, judging from everything I've read and as you just explained. I'll tell you one where it's certainly for sure that Qatar has a very good relation with the United States of America, very good relation with the Trump administration. You have a military base there that has 10,000 U.S. troops on it. You guys pay the bill for that military base. You recently gave Mr. Trump a $450 million plane. I mean, talk about bending over backward to try and do everything possible to have good relations with the United States. You would think that after all of that, you would have at least gotten a phone call from Washington saying, hey, you know, duck, heads up, something's coming, right? I don't think that phone call came.
It came 10 minutes after the explosions. We started hearing the explosions. That's when it happened. So you're correct. You know, Qatar has a very long and strong relationship with the U.S. that, you know, materialized after the invasion of Kuwait. And when the U.S. wanted to move CENTCOM somewhere else, and it, you know, Qatar offered to, you know, host the CENTCOM front command in Al Udeid Air Base, which is a Qatari base, by the way. It hosts the CENTCOM front command and some allied forces. Unfortunately, you know, my assessment is that rather than complicity, the Trump administration was made a fool of by the Israeli government. They might have given them very ambiguous, you know, reporting saying, oh, we might target a Hamas operative in the, somewhere in the region. And the response would be, oh, cool, you know, go ahead with that. And that might be the case. And because what happened is totally against U.S. national interest, because if U.S. loses its credibility as a security guarantor, this does not only affect U.S. relation with Arab states. It affects Taiwan. It affects Japan. It affects South Korea.
But
it affects all U.S. allies.
But here's the problem. They just did this. The United States and Bibi Netanyahu, you know, yin and yang here, they just did this exact thing in Iran. They told Iran, we're going to be negotiating a peace deal. Don't worry about it. No one's going to attack you. You're good for the next 24, 78 hours. You're good until Sunday night. And then they attacked on Friday night or Saturday morning, whatever it was. So exact same thing they did to you. They did, right? Say again. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So it was one day before the negotiation. When Iran and I see the analogies. The only difference is this mediation, it was sponsored by the U.S. and by Egypt. So the U.S. was a beneficiary to this discussion. in the Iran-Israel conflict, you know, the 12-day war, it might be a little different because it was an actual war. You know, we even received a volley of 20 ballistic missiles, which we intercepted 19 of. One, unfortunately, went through. And then we utilized that after being attacked to broker the peace deal.
Yeah.
So Qatar has proven that it's a, not because I'm Qatari, but that it's proven that it's a state that always pushes for peace, yeah, even if we are being attacked.
Yeah. No, you listen, you've got a reputation for that, being the moderates in the region, always trying to put different sides together. I mean, that's been what Qatar has been doing for a long period of time. The question is, should your leadership have trusted that you can have a relationship or even a conversation with the United States without assuming that Bibi Netanyahu is really in the room?
Well, you know, the U.S. has the burden of rebuilding trust now, not only with Qatar, but with all, you know, its GCC allies. You know, just to illuminate something, Qatar has been designated a major non-NATO ally, which is the highest designation in the U.S. And, you know, additional major non-NATO allies are Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, and he just signed a comprehensive defense agreement with the UAE. So if these designations, if these treaties have no meaning and no value, then I think a big reassessment has to happen, not on just Qatar's level, but regionally.
Well,
when it comes to regional security architectures.
Look, I'm American and I love America and I'm proud to be American, but I worry, like I have been reporting, that the folks running the foreign policy in America don't love America like I love America, because their decisions that are making are not good for Americans, just like the decisions I think Bibi Netanyahu is making are not good for Israelis. In fact, I don't think they're good for Jews in general anywhere in the world. So I don't criticize for the sake of criticizing. I criticize because of what you just said. If you're constantly breaking deals, if you're constantly signing treaties and not upholding them, if you're constantly saying, we're going to have a conversation and figure this out, and then the people in the conversation get bombed, and this happens repeatedly, at some point, no one's going to come to your well anymore. No one's going to visit you. No one's going to trust you. No one's going to like you. No one's going to believe in you. This is my concern for my country.
And it's true, you know, because America, from a Gulf perspective, America helped us liberate Kuwait. Mm-hmm. America helped us counterbalance some regional threats. And that's why the states of the Gulf have been very open in investing, buying American kit, hosting American troops. So what's happening now is, honestly, you know, American national interest being hijacked because of the domestic political issues of another state.
I don't know if you heard this. I was just doing my intro, as I often do before I introduced you, and I was watching my friend Tucker do a story night before last where he interviewed a whistleblower inside of the U.S. State Department who was fired. He was fired apparently because, I don't know, Bibi Netanyahu wanted him fired or NATO wanted him fired. I don't know. But he was fired essentially for telling the truth, for in many ways defending things that should be defended. He says he wrote a memo offering condolences to the five journalists, the Al Jazeera journalists who were targeted and killed by Israel. And just for offering condolences to their families is one of the reasons they used to fire him. What's your reaction to that?
I saw the show. You know, I watch Tucker a lot. And it wasn't a surprise seeing that a low-level embassy employee in West Jerusalem dictating what statements come out of the State Department.
Yeah.
But it's a question that, honestly, it's a question the Americans have to ask, because us in the region, we are very resilient, Sanchez. We are very resilient. Mm-hmm. And we're not shaken with what happened, and we will continue doing what we do best, which is building peace in the region. But, you know, now it's a question to the Americans. Do you want to be part of this? Or, you know, many analysts would say that the U.S. is going into the stage of isolationism. You know, they're staying in their hemisphere and they don't really care about what's happening outside their hemisphere. But I need to remind everybody the global order as it is now, or what's left of it, has been built in the interest of the U.S. by the U.S. And some countries were beneficiary to this, you know, mainly smaller states like ours. But, you know, the world will go on. The world will continue.
It's interesting. Basically, based on what you just said, I'm just thinking to myself, I see a change. I'm sure you've read, I just returned from Beijing, and I was there covering the summit that was held there, the cooperative summit. And I got a sense while I was there that, oh, I hate using the word New World Order because everybody uses that and it sounds trite. So I got a sense that the Global South community, the BRICS community, whatever the hell we want to call it, this new enterprise has never been stronger, has never been prouder, has never been more united than it is right now. And when I compare those countries and the GDP growth and 6.8% in places like India, 5%, China, even 3.8% in Russia, I know Qatar has relationships with Russia from a fuel and energy standpoint, et cetera. It almost seems to me it makes more sense for countries to start leaning in that direction than it is to lean in the direction of some of these old colonial countries in Europe, for example, that have zillions of problems and no GDP growth and lots of crime and lots of high taxes, et cetera. I could go on and on. Do you see that shift?
Well, you know, the writing is on the wall. I was in Beijing earlier this year speaking at an event, and I said, you know, we have to, everything follows the money. Most of the world's GDP is generated in the global south. Most of the world's people are in the global south, so both the generators and the consumers. So it's a natural shift of the center of gravity towards the east and southeast. So it's inevitable. But what the West can do is they can reintegrate themselves and redesign the relationship with the global south in a way that is mutually beneficial. But unfortunately, history tells us that that is not the case. You know, when somebody rises and somebody goes down, there is always conflict.
Yeah.
So, you know, my assessment is, unfortunately, we might be seeing more conflict.
Well, you know, we have an expression in America. It's a very famous expression, and it goes like this. You've probably heard it. You're very worldly. It says, when you're in a ditch, stop digging. And that's it. I mean, it's like I'm watching you, the Europeans. They want to continue fighting the war in Ukraine. It's like you're losing. Stop. But they're like, no. We have to keep digging. And the more you dig, the further down you go. And I don't understand it. And I know you can't speak for the United States or for the Europeans, but you could speak for Qatar. I imagine countries like Qatar and other countries in that part of the world will probably start either looking to align or aligning themselves with this new power source in the world. No?
Well, I wouldn't say align. I would say, coordinate, synergize, develop relations with. So Qatar already has really good relations with the Global South. Qatar is an advocate of South-South cooperation through hosting different forums, conferences, participating and funding different forums and conferences in the Global South. Most of our economic relationship is with countries in the Global South. You know, our main commodity is liquefied natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that's going east. Most of that's going east. So it's only natural. But in the end, Qatar, like I said, is a peace-loving nation. We will focus on building peace. We will try to balance. We like to balance that stuff. You know, we're the world's mediator of choice. We mediated in Latin America. We mediated in Africa. We're mediating in Europe. We facilitated the reunion of Russian and Ukrainian children that were displaced during the war
mm-hmm.
Through our our embassies in Europe and in Moscow. So in the end, Qatar will always play this middle role. But the fact of the matter is, most of the economic clout of the world is going towards the global south. It's already there.
What happens if the United States tries to do to you what it tried to do to India, for example, and say, if you're friends with Russia, we're going to cut you off and increase your tariffs? What if the United States or some other Western country came and told Qatar, you're not allowed to be friends with China. You're not allowed to be friends with Russia. You're not allowed to be friends with so and so. And if you are, we're not going to be your friends anymore. Which is almost like, it sounds like something high school, but that's kind of what's going on. What would Qatar's reaction be?
So first of all, I hope we wouldn't reach that case, that level of you have to choose. But, you know, I have to remind my friends in the West that it's not a zero-sum game. Both can benefit. We have our security arrangements with the West, with the U.S. And if that is sustained and we can, you know, still trust the credibility of those guarantees, we can still have an economic relation with China. If you tell the people you have a choice, they will make an economically informed choice.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you have a relationship with Rosneft, one of the biggest companies in Russia as well, because you share some of the same principles in the oil industry and in the natural gas industry. It's like the Indians say, we've got 1.4 or 5 billion people who need energy. We're going to make decisions based on what they need, not what some political decision happens to be. And I think that makes all the sense in the world. Let's finish up with two more questions, I guess. I know we've taken up a lot of your time, and you've been so kind and so generous, and you're such an affable person and such a good speaker. First of all, this summit, what do you think can come of this summit?
So it's important for us to not look at the summit as a singular event. It's part of a wider initiative to, you know, rally around peace-loving nations and nations of the region towards putting pressure on the current radical government in Israel. It started with the Security Council statement last week, which we saw very strong statements from everybody speaking except the Israeli. We saw strong statements from the Russian representative. Mm-hmm. And we also saw the U.S. condemning the Israeli action, without naming names, but condemning the action at least. So that's one thing. Second is the summit today. It shows Qatar's diplomatic power in being able to rally all of these world leaders at a very short notice. You know, you're talking about 3 or 4 days of preparation, flying everybody to Doha. The weather is still a bit warm, but I hope they enjoyed their time. But what's more important than the statement is the discussions. We will have face-to-face discussions between the leaders of the region. Hmm. Then we can see something material happening. And I'd like to also remind all of us that we have coming very soon the New York Declaration, which passed with a landslide vote. Only 22 countries either rejected or abstained from voting, which shows that the majority of the global community is for the establishment of a Palestinian state and for the Arab Peace Initiative. And, you know, this is a historical moment for Israel. The Arabs are coming with a solution. Arab states are not state threats for Israel. And this is their chance to, you know, reach a negotiated deal.
You know, some people would say you guys are just too nice. Everything you're saying seems conciliatory. But listen, I'm a Catholic. I'm a Christian. So I believe in the Prince of Peace. And Jesus Christ said that no matter what happens in your life or in your world, you should always turn the other cheek. And you guys are literally living that by example. So
We believe in Jesus. You know, as Muslims, we believe that Jesus is a prophet. And peace, we put peace above everything else. But we also like to, you know, pressure bullies to stop bullying.
So let's finish with the bully. That's the place I wanted to end the conversation with. I'm hearing all kinds of things about people predicting what's going to happen with Israel. If they continue down this path, it's not good for them. I cannot see how the world can continue to accept somebody doing what they're doing. I don't have to be specific, but I could show you the pictures. I could show you the reports, one after another, essentially saying that this is an extermination campaign. This is a genocide. And we've seen what is actually going on. And who knows when the final tally comes in, what the numbers will actually be. So how do you think the situation will end for Israel? And maybe parting last words from you would be, if you could have a conversation tomorrow with Mr. Netanyahu, what would you tell him?
Of course. So first of all, the policies of Israel now are leading to Israel's isolation. I think the only reason Arab states haven't like cut ties, the normalizer, is that there is still some glimmer of hope that we can reach a negotiated deal. It's not just political isolation, it's also economic isolation. Israel is a small state. Yeah. Israel is not very resource rich. Israel is an export economy. Most of their exports go to Europe and then to the region. And if they become isolated, it's bad for the Israeli people. Maybe, and some parting words before we end this. If I could speak to Netanyahu, I would say, think of how this region will look like for your grandchildren with the policy decisions you're taking.
Yeah, I think that's the reason that should move all of us as human beings. It's for our, fellow citizens. And most of all, I always say this, one of the reasons I do what I do for a living, one of the reasons I consider myself a truth teller or as close as I can come, although I'm imperfect, is I always think of my children and my grandchildren. And I think that's why we should do things. I'm not sure that's his motivation, but I'm not here to judge, and neither are you, but we can only hope. Rashid Al-Mohanadi, is such a pleasure talking to you. I look forward to sharing some tea with you at some point in Doha.
Whenever you're here, I'll be happy to host you.
Thank you so much. God bless. Take care.